sweetheart. There's something I had to tell you I haven't told you. And it's going to scare you. There's this actor named Charles Grodin. He's smart and charming with an easygoing vibe. He was in this movie Midnight Run, which is why they named this crazy bike race after him. That I can't stop doing. I've been riding my bike at night through red lights and stop signs and railroad tracks, against these crazy messenger guys, in between buses and oncoming traffic. Sweetheart, I guess I want to say, if I get hurt real bad, that would be okay. There'd be nothing to fix, hold, or fold, nothing to lift, or find, or transfer. Nothing to sleep on or remember, nothing to hide, forget, or figure out. Nothing to conceal or carry, break, wear down, wear out, or bury. Sweetheart, sweetheart, there's something I had to tell you I haven't told you. And it's going to scare you. There's this actor named Charles Grodin. He's smart and charming with an easygoing vibe. He was in this movie Midnight Run, which is why they named this crazy bike race after him. That I can't stop doing. I've been riding my bike at night through red lights and stop signs and railroad tracks, against these crazy messenger guys, in between buses and oncoming traffic. Sweetheart, I guess I want to say, if I get hurt real bad, that would be okay. Be nothing to fix, hold, or fold, nothing to lift, or find, or transfer, nothing to sleep on, or remember, nothing to hide, forget, or figure out, nothing to conceal, or carry, break, wear down, wear out, or bury. Sweetheart,
first, I'd like to play something. Get this on the record, so I gotta find it. I've been living without you. There it is. Okay, this next song I'm going to play, I'd like someone to find out what it is, what's it called. Don't have a record of what it is when I posted it last year. So let's put it out there for the world audience to find out what is this song, what's the YouTube for it.
Oh, and they are.
Okay. I see Sully has posted a YouTube. Let's see if he found it. He or she. Check that. Nope. It's something else. Okay, so I have... Oh, now here's Michael's offering something. Let's see what that is. I think it's a Hawaiian song. Barefoot Natives. Oh, okay. There it is. Okay, thanks, Michael. Barefoot Natives doing Fa Mai Re Oi. So, great. And we can play it any time. And I'm going to try another one here. I don't know why I saved this. Let's just see what it is. Go back a bit. So what's this one? Since we're playing a little music, let's try this song. Lamb Chop does Up With People.
We'll have some analysis of the questioning and the answers later. But now, the President of the United States.
Thank you. Yeah, there comes a booming sound. It used to come from underground. From a kind of welfare state. The soul, yeah, baby, of the soul. Love that sweet, sweet soul. Let's be certain. A deliberate monologue, as sure as if it will fall across you, unto you. Will most certainly leave the doing. And now
you're trying to think of you alive. But you can't fool me, no matter how hard you try.
Participants are now unmuted.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Jean, what do you do? You just put the sound in Shazam or something? How does that work? Is that how you find things? Name any song in seconds.
Hi, Bob.
Hello,
yeah,
Jean.
it's an app called Shazam that
so
I downloaded on my phone. And so if you just push the button, it will identify the song.
Oh, you mean if it hears it?
Yeah.
It has to hear it. So this,
yeah.
This screen will identify it. Or you have to put the app in your phone? Or will this screen do it?
You have to download the app. You can either put it in your computer or on your phone.
Okay. All right, well, that's good. And then Michael found this last one by the Love Lights, but I wasn't asking for that one. I knew that one because that was posted. I played that a few weeks ago. The thing is, I'm going back and listening to this stuff in 2016 while I do the dishes or something, and I'm hearing songs way back there. And the notice I sent to Bill to put it into the green board, those notices have been deleted somehow. So there's a whole bunch of songs I don't know now. But we now have solved it. The team has come forth with their corporate electrified intelligence, and the problem's been solved. And well, appreciate it. Barefoot natives, is that what you did, Michael? Gene, I didn't see earlier that Gene had posted it. I just saw Silly posted something, then Michael, but just before that, Gene had posted it already. So
yeah, the way I find songs, Bob, is by just typing the first lyric, the first line of the song into Google, and it normally brings it up. But I couldn't. The Barefoot Natives, I could not quite translate what they were saying into words.
You know, that's what my problem was. Yeah, I can do any song if I hear the English, but I think, I don't know if that's Hawaiian. Maybe.
It sounds Hawaiian.
Tahitian. It's on the YouTube. There's a description on the YouTube link.
Yeah, and actually the video I'm playing is live at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center in 2007.
Yeah.
The song is Tahitian. So those are not Hawaiians singing it, or Tahitians, but unless somebody, Lopaka Kolin, that's an odd name, so maybe that's a Tahitian name. Anyway, so that's good. So sorry for the extra music. We end up going on all night with the music, but this is a disciplined show. We have work to do, and we have people who have something to say, I hope. So would you like to, anybody... absorb or express what you've absorbed since Sunday? What have you taken in along these themes?
Hi, Bob. It's Sean, yeah?
Yes, Sean.
I started looking into the solutions a bit, like the negative capability and the suspending of judgment that McLuhan talked yeah. about. And then I thought, well, I'm going to look into what does that do? So I didn't come up with too much. I only found a few things that I found in a book that he highlighted. But I thought it would be nice if we could look at that, about the services of why is this actually helping you with the situation of
you
the drama
the
disservice, of cognition.
The disservices of why it's helping you.
No, the other way around. The services of it. Why is it? How does it help you?
Judgment.
Yes.
Well, right off the bat,
I can read you the quotes I wrote down.
What do you mean, write them down?
I wrote some things down that I found on it that McLuhan said.
Yeah.
Things like having surpassed the limitations of one's assumptions by criticizing them. And that's where I see that suspended judgment.
Right.
So you're criticizing your own assumptions to surpass the limitations of them. Which is, so you have to make peace with the fact that you've got those limitations.
Yeah. Now, wait a minute.
I just thought it isn't.
That may not be appropriate. So McLuhan means by the techniques of suspended judgment that the effects of the new media environments are so complex that moral judgment, moral blame is not relevant at first. You got to really figure out what's going on and so eventually perceive the ecology of it, the interacting of all these different factors. And so you you suspend your moral judgment or any ideas about it until you sort of look at it on its own terms. Then you don't have to mock or come to peace with your culturally approved assumptions you already had about new media. All you do is look at it and study the dynamics of it and see what patterns you notice without coming to any conclusions whether it's good or bad. That's the technique of suspended judgment.
I'm glad you said that, because it takes away that you have to come to peace with it.
Right.
You don't necessarily have to. Oh, excellent.
Yeah, McLuhan had a phrase, something like, every man has the right to be protected from his own ignorance. Every person has the right to be protected from their own ignorance. Basically, you put people in jail, you know. If they go around being ignorant, you help them by putting them in jail or disciplining them some way, if it's that kind of disservice they're creating. And you protect them from their own ignorance. So, anybody can tell me what that has to do with what Sean said? The second point, protecting people from their own ignorance. Now, okay, that's why you have intelligence agencies. That's why you have tetrad managers. They try to anticipate problems that can happen in society, and without anybody knowing it, you know, correct the imbalance. So far, we've proved very unsuccessful at doing that. But we can write down the idea and have it as an ideal, not recommended, but most people are presenting ideals in dealing with tensions and pressures of the wonderful life we're living.
It's almost like trying to protect people from the impact of the technologies, Bob.
Yeah, that's what McLuhan would say. He would say, let's turn off the TV environment for 6 months. He would say this back in the 50s, and realize what had happened to us while TV was on, probably for a few years, and then protect ourselves from unforeseen consequences that we could vote on or decide whether we're allowing those inevitable consequences to happen if we turn the TV environment back on again. That would be protecting society from their own ignorance. But society was too ignorant, meaning everybody thought they understood everything, to bother doing that. therefore we are now at the end of the species. We are witnessing the decline and recline of the chemical body. And some of us are glad it's gone. Good riddance. I'm not saying I am. I just said some of us, or some of you. I shouldn't have said us, should I? That includes me. Include me out. That's a phrase from the 20s. Include me out, buddy.
Well, Bob, I've been contemplating the alphabet or reading and what's actually happening when we read. I was listening to something where McLuhan spoke about our alphabet and how our alphabet is different from others because it doesn't bring an image with it. It's not based on an image. So when we read it, he said it's an act of guessing for starters because there's so many different meanings to words that one has to guess which meaning one is going to use in which context. But I also saw it as reading as the act of picturing something that's not there.
Yeah.
Of seeing something that's not there. And the damage that we can't call it damage because it's making a moral judgment, but what that does in creating that visual space and then the storylines that go with that and then living in those places. And how does one protect oneself from that?
Right. Yeah, now, so I like the way McLuhan said that the phonetic alphabet was a series of meaningless signs and meaningless sounds. You know, ah, eh, beh, keh, you know, take the vowels, A, E, I, O, U, but they're like when they're first uttered. Then they get started getting used and they become A, E, I, O, U. That's within the language. But so they're, you know, someone would point to a tree and draw an icon for it, an ideogram, and it would look like the tree approximately. But there's nothing visualizing A, E, I, O, U. So that creates an empty space. And so then then the person starts reading and has to visualize, translate the sight of the book into audible sounds and maybe picture them. I know McLuhan used to say that the young people were tending to think in images more than their parents, say from before World War II, who thought in words. So we've increasingly gone to images. That's because we aren't reading. We're just absorbing movies, media, visual media, visible media, and that becomes part of your thinking processes. So the abstract space of the phonetic alphabet is the beginning of a delay in your response to, in perception, because you have to translate the eye into ear, and then I guess back to eye again. So that is the beginning of schizophrenia.
Absolutely. And the thing of how he described that we go around and read our environment because we read our alphabet, whereas others who see their alphabet because it's pictorial or symbolic, they see their environment, and that gives us a gap, you know, that you're talking about. The isness gets moved away, and we're almost in reflection mode immediately without.
Well, there's a gap between those that perceive directly and those that go through the phonetic displacement.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean? A gap between those?
Yeah,
now, isn't that interesting? You know, a young kid learns to read. They never think about that, what we're just talking about.
Yeah.
Then it's an imbibed process. They're inside it. And then they start translating everything into books, into writing, and they don't know what it's done to them. And then when they encounter another culture that didn't do that, they don't understand why there's such a difference, other than just assuming. Well, you could say they know why there's a difference. No, they know there's a difference, but they don't know why there's a difference. So McLuhan and his school figured out why there's a difference between people, cultures, between cultures.
Yeah, and it becomes normal to read things. And instead of sitting down and being with people, we sit down and we read them like a book.
Right.
And so I've been noticing that. I think Alyssa was speaking about how when we see all these different ways of cognition, how it affects us. I was also asking the question over the last couple of weeks, how is McLuhan applicable in my life? How do I apply what I'm getting here on the new coach house? And it actually happens to you as you have these insights. You start seeing your own processes. And one of the huge ones for me was seeing the difference between the event, which is what's happening on TV. It's just an ongoing event. Or the storyline, that's the movie or the book or the picture. Seeing that when I'm in my life, when I'm struggling usually in a situation or having contrast that I'm not doing well with, it's because I'm not in an event, I'm in a storyline. Yeah. And I've been able to notice that fixation of trying to stay with the storyline in an environment now where there isn't one.
That's right. And, you know, you had Nick on What You Just Say bawling his head off because he realized his whole life he'd been living in the rearview mirror, which I'm not sure what he means. But and Nick was quite
I think that's what he meant.
Yeah, that's
well,
what he meant.
We had a conversation about that, and it was about really living in that story and trying to keep a story, like the story we were speaking on the last program about having a family, and everyone's taking photographs of family meetings to try and prove that this thing called family still exists, the story of a family.
The narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll see in college they call it the narrative.
Yes, the narrative.
Yeah, the narrative's in their lives. Their term. The linear. So we look, and so now we're in this digital, simultaneous, all around, post cyclical situation where there's no time to make a narrative.
Yep.
And we finally got a president who doesn't bother hiding that.
Yes.
There's
yes,
no narrative needed, people. I'm just reacting. I'm just a dangling ganglia.
Yeah.
So, well,
he's the narrative.
Yeah, he's the narrative. What he says goes.
Yeah.
We're making the market. But, see, once you start thinking about these matters, these perceptual media matters, hearing anybody talk about, say, the presence process or any kind of techniques of awareness or yoga is limited. They're not even beginning to notice what's around them today. They're lost in a story about a former way of making yourself aware in a simpler media environment.
Well, it's still too confined to chemical astral body, and that's what you say.
Yeah.
The Thompson quadrant is a trap for that. So when one doesn't include all the other aspects of what's going on, then it's just an incomplete scenario that's not going to take you. It's going to take you into a cul-de-sac is all it does.
Yeah, you'll find people trying to get rid of their narrative. They call it getting rid of your ego or getting rid of Descartesian mind-body split, which is another narrative. And they're struggling to get rid of something. They don't know how it got there.
Right.
Now, if you know how it got there, it falls away pretty quickly in terms of hypnotizing you.
Yeah.
That's why I was wailing yesterday, Bob.
You were wailing, not crying?
That's why. No, that's
why,
that's why
wailing.
I was wailing. I can't believe it. It's been a story forever.
Well, it was very nice to have someone, first human in the world to admit that they discovered the rearview mirror. Well, what do you think? Is the rearview mirror narratives in your life? Like, well, I didn't go into it. What do you mean by rearview mirror?
Well, I think there's two things happening here, Bob. One is that if you're looking in the rearview mirror, you've got a past image and a future image, or what's in the now. So the rearview mirror is everything in the past. So we try and create these stories that we lived in. You know, I had a family, or I had a – and everybody sits around the campfire and goes, oh, let me tell you a story. And they go way back to 20, 30 years ago. So-and-so died, or so-and-so did this, and let me tell you the story. And you kind of realize that that's all we're doing is living in a story. And
really,
because at the end of the day, it's that past story is what really inculcates us in that moment, and it's not that story. We're not there anymore. It's like, and who believes
that? And that's where emotion comes from. Probably emotion.
That's where emotion comes in there. So when I got that aha moment, I went, oh, my word. You know, everybody is trying to take a photograph to live out the story, to post it on Facebook or to do this so that they can remember the rearview mirror, the story, and not see what's going on in the event, which is right now.
Right.
And the event is, so it's, call it the present moment or whatever you want to call it, but that's the moment. Right now is what's really mattering. It's not, or what matters, not what happened yesterday or the day before or 30 years ago.
Or how about this? It's not 30 years ago. It all matters, and it's still part of your being. It's just not in the past. Mm. It's not part of an older definition. It's still unfolding. It's part of today's narrative and influence today's narrative. But you don't want to make too much of a narrative about it. Don't make any conclusions. The mind can't make conclusions.
Does the problem not come? Okay, let's put it in another category. What happens then when you dream? So I wake up and I go, oh, Bob, I had this great dream. What was that? That's a narrative. That's a story. And I have to relate that story because it was really real. So
yeah, but wait a minute. If you believe that you went to another world and you never fell asleep, you know, scientists, no one's ever slept. They just go to other worlds. Then, first of all, it's an experience. Then you might not have to make a narrative about it. You just had what you remember of it.
It was an event.
But then how do you tell the story?
You don't tell the story. who's listening? Who's listening anymore? You said, I'm talking to yourself again. But this is what's really interesting about Ion. Ion is perceptual training. Ion is always undermining the story in many different techniques. He's undermining your mind's natural tendency to make a story, which could be just a definition of what a protein is. That's a story.
Hmm.
And then you see how Finney's Wake is a great training on these habits.
Yes.
But then by definition, by McLuhan's definition, we should all be in the crazy house. Or maybe we are in the crazy house and we just don't know.
Well, I'm not going to name it. I'm not going to make a narrative about what house I'm in. I remember how McLuhan said, he says, my technique does not come from thought. His communication does not come from thought. That's another way of trying to say what we're trying to say right now. Not bringing a narrative into it. You suggest
that unpack
I'm looking
that,
at media
Bob.
In their own terms. What? Unpack it?
Yeah, because you can't just throw that out. We all have a thought.
I know. I don't know what the hell he's
talking
about.
Otherwise, I'm going to... It's getting more desperate, Bob. I'm going to start screaming and crying and wailing on the floor.
I have ideas about what he might have meant, but I'm not saying my narratives about what that sentence was, which I can't remember where I saw it. I was just reading one of his letters or something. You know, a couple of weeks ago I found it and just said it. He said it doesn't come from thought. Don't know where that was, but it's interesting. One interpretation was that he's acting. He's not thinking about something to say. He's taking a few lines, a formula. He does say he has a formula, and applying it to every situation. So when Tom Wolfe and I think it was Herb Cain and people in San Francisco took him to a topless restaurant in 1965, most of them, Tom Wolfe and them, were kind of a bit embarrassed. And Tom Wolfe tells the story that McLuhan wasn't nonplussed at all. He just started saying, you lower the lights, that creates a more tactile awareness,
yes.
Lowers the... He started analyzing the sensory environment. and here they knew this guy was a Catholic, attends mass every day kind of person, might be a slightly Victorian or Puritan, and so they thought he'd get upset with these, breasts hanging down in front of him. Carol Doda, Google her, D-O-D-A, she was the famous topless woman who got, featured in Life magazine when this fad started in San Francisco. And read the Tom Wolfe description of how McLuhan was just looking at it as a laboratory and describing the effect of lower lights and this kind of stuff and that kind of stuff. They were all flabbergasted by this guy. But he was using his senses technically. You know, there. I don't know if there was any emotion in it, any humanist story. Yeah. And so he was responding to the sensory impact, which is what he did all along. When I read him what Cosmic Awareness said about his technique, he says, that sounds like a lot of double talk. What I do is he looks over and he picks up a pair of glasses, which I hadn't even noticed. He says, see these glasses? I wonder where they came from. So on the surface, well, they come from you. You put them down. They're your glasses. But no, he meant technically as an environment or as an object, where did it come from? You know, he starts analyzing the thing, his immediate experience. Now, Barry Nevin called McLuhan's work an epistemology of experience, analyzing experience, analyzing what Michael thought he was teaching, you know, analyzing the sensory input of the present.
McLuhan did say that he was driven initially by his emotions, so he didn't use that word, but he did say that initially the things that upset him in his environment, that's what he paid attention to. And initially he said it upset him, but then he started to look at them. And when he started to look at them, then he started to be educated by them about what was going on. So then
Hold it, Michael. That was the Playboy interview where he says, when I was younger or a long time ago, I hated cities. I hated industry. I considered the Industrial Revolution as the fall of man. That statement? That's the quote you're thinking of?
It's not that statement, but it's the same sentiment that he was communicating. Yeah.
Yeah, and he said, I started to look at the advertising around me without moral judgment or without a story.
Yes. And he also said that judgment wasn't personal. So he couldn't apply judgment because he was judging the entire population then if he was judging.
Yeah, he said, how can I condemn, you know, millions of people for using the book, you know, or using the automobile? It's interesting, though, once the satellite came in, which created this neurotic need for some kind of ecology, people had no compunction of telling everybody to stop driving cars, you know. they actually did become moralistic. A lot of heat and sound and fury. He also said, when he would talk about literacy comes out of civilization, or civilization is caused by literacy, and that pre-literate cultures, or what we call barbaric cultures, he would say, I'm not using barbarian or civilization with value judgment, I'm talking technically. That's what he would say.
Yes.
I'm talking technically. Yes. That literacy, visual bias, creates civilization.
And it's interesting, Bob, that he had such an emotional response on people. I was actually listening to a conversation between two professors sometime in the 60s who were talking about McLuhan and calling him the destroyer of civilization, you know, that when he speaks. One can see how he's not being emotional about it, but he sure had a trigger on people who were listening to him.
He triggered them.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, what did you start off saying that he, I don't know what your first sentence was, okay, these two guys were emotional about him.
Yeah, they were calling him. They said they attended his lecture, and the one gentleman said that his wife whispered to him, this man is the destroyer of civilizations, by his words.
Now, Walter
Bower
agreed. Said that. Yeah. Walter Bower said that to me. You know, Walter knew a bit about McLuhan, but once he met me in 1979, and he was the last guest at the last Monday night seminar, December 3rd, 1979, McLuhan had his stroke to September 26, 79. So Eric ran the last one, and I got Walter to be the last presenter of something. So he talked about MK Ultra. But after, say, 6 months of talking in depth about McLuhan, so I was, quote, educating him, he eventually said, you know, Marshall and Barry were destroying the West. They were actually destroying the world. People get to that point of moral judgment, immature thinking, rearview mirror, they eventually get to that. They start to perceive that McLuhan's talking about something that's devastating to our values, because literacy is gone. So McLuhan wasn't destroying civilization. He was saying, you have successfully destroyed your civilization. And nobody had realized it. That's what they were really responding to. But they decided he, you know, blame the messenger. He used to tell the story that the criticism of me is like, if I had gone next door and knocked on the door to tell the neighbor that his roof's on fire, and the guy hears me tell him his roof's on fire, so he calls the cops because he thinks I started the fire.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
When he told that, you know, he was on a TV show, and he told the people on the TV show, they asked him, are you saying that TV people are less literate than book people? And he said, absolutely. And they said, they reacted to that as if it was a personal judgment on them. And he said, no, it's not a judgment. It's talking about a TV creates a different type of awareness. It doesn't make you more stupid. It's a different type of awareness. But they couldn't accept that different type of awareness category. They were holding so desperately on trying to be, on using literate as a sort of an expression of accomplishment.
Yes. And so he's doing this in the 50s, right at the beginning of this new world, the electronic world. They had radio movies, but it wasn't as, you know, devastating as television, computers, and the satellites. So the interaction with the audience we have of him, you're watching people project their literate assumptions on reality, that it was the most important medium. And they had no clue about it. You're looking at superstitious people. And when someone blames you, if you tell them something that's going on and they don't like it and they blame you, that's actually a subliminal awareness that words are powerful. And that if I say something, I'm creating it. So the citizen is reacting to McLuhan. If you're saying I got a fire, you're creating it. You know, this is what Ian says we do. But people think that's what they're doing, but they're not aware of the implications of it. They're inside it, and they're emotional inside it. But they actually believe that if you say something, you're going to create it. They're superstitious. And that's why, you know, a lot of New Agers get into, I don't want to think bad thoughts. And then if you actually think what Ian pointed out, just think of all the bad thoughts you actually did. If thoughts affected reality, we would have destroyed this world a long time ago, because there's been a lot of pissed off people having bad thoughts for thousands of years. It didn't affect anything. And that's a very simple, logical narrative there, but it makes sense. It's very interesting that it's like Zappa saying, well, you guys think that, you know, my pornographic songs or obscene lyrics are affecting people's behavior. Well, look at all the love songs. I don't see it a more loving world because people are listening to love songs.
Yeah.
Very good point.
Yeah.
So what is affecting people?
The people listening to love songs are usually fighting with their lovers.
Yeah, usually sad songs. Now, I think Ginny once said, Bob, you tend to play sad songs or sad themes. I said, I don't even notice the words. It's the harmonies, the chords, the emotion I'm responding to. I didn't know they were bad songs. So after a while, I started, there's another bad song I played. And that one, Jesus Christ, they would think that I'm trying to divorce Carolyn or something. I play so many bad songs with bad themes, lost themes, broken up, but I find they have the most neat music, like what we open with, the Charles Grodin song. That's a sad song. Yeah.
Seems like Bill's also been infected by that, Bob.
Bill?
Bill, yeah, playing that song, our theme song at the beginning now. Didn't you say he plays it now at the beginning of every
station?
Yeah,
he wants to hear it as much as possible. He plays it on other people's programs. He has a really funny song before Carolyn's show on Monday. A very nice song. I don't know what it is, but it's from the 60s. It's I really like it. And the show that's on before Carolyn, they play it. They end it. And Carolyn hates the song. She's not as tolerant of sappy music as I am, and what she thinks is sappy music.
Well, I agree with her on that particular song.
you agree with her?
On that particular song, yes.
You know the song I'm talking about.
Yes. It's up to you. You.
Oh, yeah. It's up to you.
Well done, Michael.
Sing it for me, Michael. Do it. Well, let's all be quiet. Let's have Michael do it.
It's like a member of it, Bob. It's like
what is it?
You can imagine.
It's up
one
to
of the
you?
Lines. it's up to you, 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 and something like that.
That's quite a good one.
The lyric, but it's a very, very kumbaya, you know.
Yeah. One day, we were with Bo were driving around in Aspen, Colorado, where he lived, and we had the car radio on, and Walter had never seen me in a musical environment before. So I'm sitting in the back seat, and I'm singing along with this sappy song on the radio. And Walter thinks I'm this monster media, you know, analyst, very detached, almost like a psychiatrist, almost like a cold person. And I saw him looking in the car mirror, looking at me like totally shocked as I was singing along with a zappy song. He couldn't believe it. I became this like retarded person.
Seduced
by the simplest music. And then we were somewhere else, and somebody put the radio on by the swimming pool, and I started dancing around. And Walter leaped up, holy shit, Bob's a fucking dancer. Look how good he's dancing. And he's got everybody to look at me dancing. I was just, you know, moving my body, and I am a good dancer. But